from 90.9 WBUR, I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, Boston officials outline a new plan for more housing in the city.
We know Boston is still too expensive. We know that there's not enough affordable housing. We'd be lying if we said that we had enough.
Also today, a mother's story of dealing with her daughter's addiction.
Oh, I'm being too hard on her. It's hormones. It's the boyfriend upset her. It's this, that. And I think about the spoons. I mean, really, seriously, we wound up with like 4 spoons. I looked over at my son one day and he was eating Cheerios with an iced teaspoon. I was like, what are you doing? And he's like, we had, I don't have any spoons. I was not thinking heroin. When I looked at her, I looked at my little girl that played softball and you know, sang in the church choir.
And a lawsuit is dismissed against the T's general manager, accusing him of falsifying financial reports at his last job. That's all coming up next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. The city of Boston is growing much faster than expected. The latest estimates have the city's population jumping to 760,000 people by the year 2030, and that's 50,000 more people than previous estimates. So, Boston Mayor Marty Walsh is outlining a new plan to increase housing. His goal is to develop 69,000 housing units by the year 2030, and that amends his original housing plan by adding some 16,000 additional units. The mayor's plan comes the same day that new figures were released showing that the median price of a single-family home in Greater Boston is now at $625,000. So, how do those ever-increasing prices affect the market and housing policies, and what do you make of this growth? Joining us to talk about this is Tim Reardon. He's Director of Data Services for the Metropolitan Area Planning Council, which worked with Boston to develop this new housing plan. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having us, Deb.
Also on the line is the Chief of Housing and Director of Neighborhood Development for the City of Boston, Sheila Dillon. Hello, Sheila. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Glad to be here.
So I want to start with this prediction of 760,000 people by 2030. We have a bit of tape here from Brian Golden, who's director of the Boston Planning and Development Agency. He spoke at a roundtable meeting with reporters at the mayor's office yesterday. Let's listen.
From 1980 to 2010, we grew modestly, about 1,500 people net gain per year, adding about 50,000 over 30 years. And then in the past 6 years, we've added another 50,000. So 50,000 over 30 years, followed by 50,000 over 6 years.
Whew. So that's a big jump, 50,000 over 30 as opposed to 50,000 over 6. Tim, you dug into these numbers. So what happened here? Why did Boston suddenly get so popular?
Well, you know, it's a situation, it's a confluence of a number of factors. I mean, a lot of it has to do with the incredible strength of the Metro Boston economy and all the jobs that are being added in Boston, in Cambridge, Somerville, and a number of other surrounding communities that are attracting young workers to come fill those jobs. And it's also compounded by an increasing preference for young householders to live in the city and to live in urban areas and to avoid living in far-flung suburban locations where they don't have all the amenities and convenience of living in the city.
So it's primarily young folks who want to live in the city and possibly not drive. We're not talking about driving typically. I mean, do we know a little bit more about these folks?
Yeah, that's right. A lot of that population growth is driven by changes in migration patterns among younger residents. And really, a lot of it is also, you know, folks who traditionally would have moved out of Boston when they hit their 30s and started having kids or moved out of urban areas who are sticking around and driving that increased population growth, as well as increased international immigration, which is also affecting it as well.
So, Sheila, I'm just wondering, where do you think most of these new units might go, according to Marty Walsh's new plan?
Sure. So the BPDA, our planning agency, has done a fabulous job over the last 4 years doing a lot of neighborhood planning and an overall city plan. And they really have identified areas that they think are ripe for growth. They're by good transit. They're light industrial areas that are now obsolete. And most neighborhoods are feeling pretty good about, if you put the housing there, we will support it. So areas in South Boston, Suffolk Downs, There's parts of Dorchester that we feel could have a lot more capacity. So we do want to be much more intentional about the growth, and we think that's going to, you know, get us more support to grow the housing stock.
Now, we do know that in some neighborhoods, residents have expressed concerns about traffic, about transportation, about prices, right? There's all of those things. So Sheila, what would happen in terms of city planning? And Tim, I want you to weigh in on this too. What would happen in terms of city planning to address some of those concerns on the part of residents?
Sure. So the traffic is a concern, and I think people are feeling that the traffic is up. But traffic's up in part because so many people are commuting into Boston because there's so many jobs. So it doesn't just because we're building more housing in Boston doesn't necessarily it's going to make the traffic worse. In fact, it might make the traffic better. We are very, very intentional, though. The vast majority of the new housing and the new housing that is planned is within a half-mile walk to a major transit stop. So we always want to encourage developers and new residents to take public transportation and not have as many cars. And the BPDA is allowing many developments not to have a one-for-one parking space anymore because people are giving up their cars when they move into the city.
And what about affordable? Let's talk about affordable. So this plan includes about 15,000 affordable housing units, I'm told. So tell me, what is affordable in this market where we find out today that the average home price in Greater Boston is $625,000, and what's middle income?
Sure. So first and foremost, we need to build housing for a range of incomes. And that is serving our lowest income folks that are making, $15,000, $16,000 a year, up to our middle class. And so we have put forth a goal. We want to build almost 16,000 new units of affordable housing. That would bring our overall city number to 70,000 units of deed-restricted income. But you do get a question a lot, what's affordable? What's affordable? It's affordable at a range of incomes. And, we need to serve the poorest folks that are here, but we also need to make sure that our middle-class folks that are, working two jobs and they also need a good rent that they can afford and or a home to raise their children. So it's very, very intentional about we want to see a range of incomes. We also want the market to build housing for the middle class. So while we're trying to fund and put out land and do everything we can to increase the affordable housing stock, we really need the market, our developers, to build in less pricey neighborhoods where land is cheaper and build more modest, housing units. So it's a combination of those two things that I think are going to, serve Boston well.
And middle income, what would be the cutoff?
So most of what is deed restricted and called middle income, it's, $50,000, $60,000 for a household. When we say it's affordable, the market is creating a product that is more affordable to a middle-income household, we say, anywhere up to $125,000. That's two adults working and making $60,000 a piece. Mm-hmm. So that's sort of generally how we think about it.
Mm-hmm. And then what will this cost the city?
So to build this affordable housing, we need to spend $50 million a year. But I should say that that's only 19% of the development costs. The rest need to come from our state partners and the federal government. And the state has been fabulous. They are funding they have money in almost all of our affordable housing projects. The federal government over the last 10 years has really cut back on the amount of money they're putting up for affordable housing. So we need to continue to lobby them for additional resources.
Tim, I wonder if you could weigh in here a bit in terms of planning and how to plan for housing developments, large numbers of housing units, to try to mitigate some of the negative consequences that residents are concerned about, like traffic and the lack of affordable housing.
Right. So sure, traffic is certainly one. And it's essential as we build and design those and permit those new housing developments that they're done in a way that allow people choices for how they get around and minimize the impacts. So that can be done by reducing the amount of parking that's available on site to discourage residents from owning cars and building it in such a way that encourages them to use alternative modes of transportation. And it also has to go back to improving our transportation system so that's a reliable safe and convenient option for people to get around. But, you know, Sheila's right. A lot of the traffic and transportation challenges that folks are seeing on the roadways are not due to new housing construction, but due to increased commuting, because people are commuting in because they can't afford a house in the city or in the inner core. And also things like the rise of ride hailing and that are adding more cars to the road. Right. So the more that we can provide better alternatives for people to avoid that, the more they'll be able to find housing choices that work for them.
Are there other communities that have done something like this? $50 million a year sounds like a lot. Sounds like a significant investment on the part of a community to deal with affordable housing. Is this modeled after anything that you're aware of?
Other major cities in the country that are seeing increased population are trying to grow their own resources to build more affordable housing. But certainly Boston is putting more money in than any other city or town in Massachusetts. Mm-hmm. We are excited that MAPC, Mayor Walsh and Mayor Curtone are co-chairing a group looking at regional production. I think there's an announcement that's going to be made in the next couple of weeks. So we do need other cities and towns outside of Boston to build, but to build also more affordable housing.
Tim, what would your thoughts be about that?
The public investment is tremendously important. We certainly need more, and I agree that Mayor Walsh and his administration and the state have put in a lot of money. There's also opportunities to look more to the private sector to find other ways to have them fund more of the affordable housing through the inclusionary development policy, through the preservation of existing affordable units. And there's a number of those strategies that have been used successfully in other cities around the country and that are reflected in this housing plan that the city released yesterday.
I wonder, and I'd like to ask both of you, how do you figure in a recession in all of this? Because eventually you would think that housing prices are going to have to at least stop, plateau at some mm-hmm. point. And also, we have this issue that we heard about in a study by the Institute for Policy Studies recently, and that was that many of the high-end properties in Boston are actually not lived in. They're investments. And so what does that do to housing and the whole market and planning for something like that? How do you address that? Tim, you first.
Sure. So I'll take the Policy Studies Institute report. I mean, I think that identified a challenge in which housing stock is not used to live. There's certain segments of the housing stock that are not used for living, but as investment vehicles. And that's unfortunate because those are units that could be, that could be lived in or that we hope are contributing to solving the supply crisis, but are not doing so. That study did examine a very small slice of production over the last 20 years. So less than 3% of all the units fell into that category. And the majority of what's being produced is actually being occupied. But we do need to, there are tools to manage the prevalence of units that are either used for investment or for short-term rentals. The city has adopted an ordinance on that. The state adopted legislation to help manage that. And those are important steps to help bring those units back into the rental market or back into the for sale market. Because it's essential that it would actually be a good thing if our vacancy rates for units that are for sale or for rent actually went up a little bit, because it would mean that renters have a little more choice, buyers have a little more choice, and landlords and sellers have a little less power over the market so that things would become a little more affordable.
Mm-hmm. Sheila, your thoughts about that, especially in terms of preparing for another, at least a plateau in real estate prices?
Sure. So I agree. I'm thrilled that I just want to chime in here. We are thrilled that we did pass short-term rental regulations a couple months ago, because every unit that is built should be occupied by a resident of Boston. We feel very strongly about that. You know, the numbers, the production numbers, and I'm not a demographer, but the production numbers that we put forth yesterday factor in not a straight line of growth and economic growth and population growth. It does take into consideration some recessions and some years where there won't be as robust growth. So those projections are in there. Right now, we get a lot of our resources for affordable housing production from the market, from the private market. So in some ways, a heated market puts a lot more pressure on rents and sales prices. The flip side of that is when the market is very strong, we're extracting millions more dollars so we can invest in affordable housing and the preservation of the public housing that we have. So While I would probably welcome not a recession by any means, but rents and sales prices increases becoming more moderate, it will mean that we will have less money to invest in affordable housing. So it's the downside to any kind of downturn in the market.
Okay, Sheila Dillon, Chief of Housing and Director of Neighborhood Development for the City of Boston. Thanks so much for being with us.
Our pleasure.
Also, Tim Reardon, Director of Data Services for the Metropolitan Area Planning Council. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you, Deb.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Deborah Becker, and this is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. All this month, Boston Mayor Marty Walsh is holding a series of events about addiction and the opioid epidemic. Tonight is what the mayor calls Recovery Book Club, where he'll sit down with authors Sam Quinones, who wrote the book Dreamland, and Maureen Cavanaugh. Although Cavanaugh is a new author, she's well known in the Massachusetts recovery community, primarily for starting the nonprofit Magnolia New Beginnings. It helps families dealing with addiction. Cavanaugh's book is a memoir about dealing with her daughter Katie's drug problem, something Cavanaugh says she initially denied was happening.
In the very beginning, what her early drug use looked like looks a lot like adolescence and young adulthood. She was being a brat. You know, as much as I loved her, she was just, you know, going out, sleeping too late, just, you know, kind of, but she was still working and going to school and volunteering. So I said to him, oh, I'm being too hard on her. It's hormones. It's the boyfriend upset her. It's this, that. And I think about the spoons. I mean, really, seriously, we wound up with like 4 spoons. I looked over at my son one day and he was eating Cheerios with an iced teaspoon. I was like, what are you doing? And he's like, we don't have any spoons. But I thought that, you know, when your kids have a yogurt and they have the spoon and then they throw the yogurt and the spoon out, that's what I was thinking. I was not thinking heroin. When I looked at her, I looked at my little girl that played softball and you know, sang in the church choir. I didn't look at a potential person with a potential substance use disorder. It wasn't on my radar.
But Cavanaugh could no longer deny the problem when one day she realized that Katie, who was then 22 years old, had stolen all of her jewelry.
The idea that she would have a problem so huge that she would feel like she needed to steal some very sentimental pieces of jewelry from me, and basically all the jewelry I had, but that she would feel that she needed to do that was just, I couldn't get my head around it.
Right, right. And you confronted her.
I did. I called her up and I said, Katie, my jewelry is missing and I know you did it. Get over here. And she did.
And she admitted then that she had a problem.
She was almost relieved that I found out, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Although I don't think she realized what was next.
Yeah. And so then you tried to get her into treatment.
Well, we pretty much threatened her. Her father came right over. She came over and, you know, the state of her, she was a disaster. And she had track marks all over her arms. And it would be like right now if the sky turned purple and, you know, the streets burst into flames. That's how shocked we both were. We told her that we would have her arrested if she didn't go to treatment.
Yeah, you would have her charged with stealing your jewelry if she didn't go.
And her boyfriend, who was with her at the time.
Yeah.
And she was more concerned about him than she was about herself.
Cavanaugh's book details the toll that Katie's addiction took on the entire family. Katie was in and out of dozens of treatment programs. Sometimes Cavanaugh didn't know where Katie was, so she would drive around looking for her. At one point, she says, she saw the headline of a local news story that said, "Local honors student arrested for prostitution." It took Cavanaugh a few minutes to realize that the article was about Katie. When we met with Cavanaugh recently at her North Reading home, she told us of the moment when she knew she had lost control. Katie was at another treatment center, and Cavanaugh knew that Katie was going to run away, as she had done countless times before, with an older man named Bob. Bob would often pick up Katie and let her do drugs and live with him.
There was a moment that I think I just snapped. The answer to me was to kill him. I got in my car and got a baseball bat and started to drive over to the treatment center. And I had called the treatment center, and I, of course, didn't tell them I had what my plan was, but I told them that I was on my way over there. She came out and saw me and flipped that I was there, and from across the parking lot I could see his car. And I had to make a decision whether it was more important to stay with her and try to talk her into my car or to drive over there and kill him. And I think I would have done it at that point. I really do. Because I wasn't right. There was, like, I had had enough and I was going to end this portion of this.
So what happened? You got her in the car to talk to you? What happened?
Yeah, it was probably because I was completely out of my mind, stayed unbelievably calm, and was able to talk her into the car. And he was still sitting there. She got into the car and she asked me, "Mom, why do you have a bat in the car? Why is Liam's bat, her brother's bat, in the car?" And I said, "I'm going to kill Bob with it." I was just, like, flat. And she texted him quickly, and boy, did he get out of that parking lot fast.
That is unbelievable.
Yeah. Bob is no longer with us, by the way.
No.
And I did not do it.
At least you're not going to say that in a broadcast interview,
right? I would not. No, I would not. But I really seriously did not do it.
Aside from something as dramatic as wanting to kill someone, you also write about your day-to-day kind of existence while this was going on, constantly checking Facebook Messenger and trying to figure out where she was she still alive, and always saying I love you when you texted her or talked with her, because you didn't know if it was going to be the last time you'd ever speak with her or hear from her. But there's a part in the book where you write about some of this, and I'm wondering if you might read a little bit of this, if you don't mind.
I continue my slide into oblivion, being in a room while totally removed from everything going on around me. I forget what I am saying in the middle of sentences. I try to participate in life, but it is all an act, and I fool myself into believing that I am playing it well. I may look like I am making dinner or talking about the news, but I am either wondering what Katie is doing or trying to figure out what I can do to help her. I can't turn it off. It's like cable news in my head. I am not available to anyone, not even myself.
I feel like that all the time.
I felt like that all of the time. I felt like I was floating somewhere above my life.
And what about getting support at that point? Do you also write about the fact that it was in the newspaper that Katie was arrested, and you felt very alone? Did you have any support to try to deal with these overwhelming feelings?
I mean, at that point, the only person that I had was Randy, my boyfriend, and my ex-husband to talk to. We then, you know, mistakenly thought that we, early on, that we should be quiet about things and that it was going to be a blip, you know, and that we didn't want this to follow her. But then when she was arrested and the paper decided to print it in the paper, I started to reach out.
So a lot of folks who deal with addiction say, you know, let them hit bottom. Were you enabling? How did you sort of decide how best to handle your daughter in such a chaotic situation? And what advice then do you give other parents about that?
I personally think bottom is dead, so we don't want them to hit bottom. I don't think that whole tough love thing, to me, doesn't make any sense. So I don't know what the answer is. I only know that a person can only go with their gut. Because everything I did during that period of time, I said to myself, can I live with this if she dies? That was always my barometer. So if she called me up and she was hungry, I would find food for her. I would get food to her. If she wanted to call me and tell me that she loved me or text me, I wanted that being to be available. And that was my thing that I could deal with. But I could not have her living in the house, because I had other children in the house, and because the thought of waking her up and her being gone, I couldn't stand that idea. And I guess there was some part of me that felt that if I let her back home, it would prolong things. And I don't know if that's true or not. I don't know. But it's what I could deal with. And that's all you really can do in this horrible situation, is go with what your gut tells you to do, no matter what anybody else says.
You also write about treatment, and your daughter Katie was in dozens of treatment programs, and of course some of them not so good. At one point you were talking with a treatment program in Florida. You were talking with a treatment center there about her, how she was doing, and then come to find out that she wasn't really even there. So,
oh my God, that was so horrible.
I think there are big problems, yeah. You know, with treatment. What was your relationship like with her when she was in treatment, and what advice do you then give parents about finding treatment?
It's hard. I mean, I think length of stay is probably the most important thing. And where can you find that? It's very difficult to find that. For the most part, we're bringing people in and giving them 5 to 7 days in detox, and then 14 to 21 days in clinical stabilization or actual treatment, what they call it. And that depends on your insurance. So we're very fortunate in Massachusetts where there's some clinical stabilization, but not a lot of it. So you have to fight for that. And how much can be done in such a short period of time? We're forgetting about the next step after treatment. So whether good, bad, and different, even if they just set someplace for 30 days, I think we're forgetting about what happens when they go out into the rest of the world and they can't get a job because maybe they have a criminal record or the employer wants to know what you've been doing for the last 2 years. This is where we have to, I think, focus our attention. And, you know, treatment is tough because there is no real gold standard. This is the way we do treatment, and this is what should happen. When people come to me and say, what's the best place? I think in my mind, well, what do I know is the safest place? Where do I know that there's nothing awful happening? That shouldn't be
the standard.
No, right. It should not be the
What's
standard.
What's not awful?
Right. Yeah. And where are they going to be safe? Well, maybe their brain heals for 30 days, and that's not enough time. But it's mostly afterwards that I am more concerned about.
Where is Katie now?
Katie, I am so very, very happy to say, has almost 14 months of sobriety. And she's working and starting school in October. No one thought Katie was going to make it. I mean, even Katie didn't think Katie was going to make it. I always remained hopeful, but I was always prepared for the worst too, or I tried to. You can never prepare yourself for that, but I tried in my head to prepare myself for the fact that it didn't look good. And I had many people tell me to prepare myself. And I'm so thrilled that she's doing well. And she struggles every day. This is a struggle. And but I feel like every day that she's here is just a gift.
What I imagine another question you always ask yourself was why, right? Why did she start? Why did she keep doing it? What does she say about why?
I think she never felt like she fit in. And she was always always on some level depressed and anxious. And I don't know that I'm sure I didn't see the extent of it. But when she started to use drugs, she didn't feel that way anymore.
And we're here in your house in North Reading. You've moved from Marblehead. Was the move part of maybe starting all over again and hoping to put that behind you in a way?
Yeah, I mean, Marblehead was tough. When the worst of it was going on, and having been a teacher in the school system, everybody knew, and no one reached out. And there's a scar there that, you know, that I had enough of that town, and there's some good people there that came around, and I've gotten to know a lot of people that have had the same struggles with their own children. But people, I think that if there's anything to be learned from that, that it's important to reach out to somebody when they're in trouble, you know, especially when their children are in trouble, because you may make the mistake of reaching out to somebody who doesn't want to talk about it. But more than likely, you're going to make somebody feel like they're not alone anymore.
So now that it seems almost as if, you know, you never want to say it's over, right? But
right.
You're moving in another direction, maybe. But you're still doing this work all the time, and you're reminded of it all the time. Is that a good thing or a bad thing?
Well, every once in a while, I want to go work at a bookstore.
Right. I mean, do you want to do this all the time and keep doing this?
Somebody has to do it. Somebody has to do it. I think there needs to be a face on this, and there needs to be some real raw honesty about what went on and what it's like in order for it to change. And I'm hoping to be part of that. We can't look to the people who have lost their children to carry the people that still have their children. You know, we see these figures in the newspaper. There's 72,000 people, and I say, picture Foxborough Stadium full. And that's what 72,000 people look like. And people look at me and think, oh my God, it's not just a number. Those seats are filled with people.
And those are the number of people dying every year from opioid
overdoses. That's last year. There'll be more this year. Mm-hmm. And that's not taking into account all the disease, the cellulitis, the endocarditis, the cirrhosis, the things that affect people. Let's fill another 4 stadiums with all the people that are heartbroken that are left behind. So this is affecting so many people, and everybody, and I understand it. Parents want to think that this can't happen to them. I wanted to think that this couldn't happen to me. So we build up a little wall, and we say, well, we went to church, and we had Sunday dinner, and they have 2 parents that love them, and they played sports, and they do all these things. And we build up walls and think, this is the reason why it can't happen to me. But I'm here to say that I did all of those things too, and it happened to me.
Well, thanks so much for taking the time to talk with me.
Thank you very much for coming.
Maury Kavanaugh is founder of Magnolia New Beginnings, a peer support group for those whose loved ones are affected by addiction. Her new memoir is titled If You Love Me, A Mother's Journey Through Her Daughter's Opioid Addiction. She'll be speaking with Boston Mayor Marty Walsh and author Sam Quinones as part of the Mayor's Recovery Month Book Club. That'll be at the Old South Church in Boston starting at 6 tonight. Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Deborah Becker, and this is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. We want to provide an update now on some of the financial troubles at the Texas company once led by MBTA General Manager Luis Ramirez. A federal judge has dismissed a lawsuit against Ramirez and the company Global Power Equipment Group. In a separate development, the company says the Securities and Exchange Commission has finished its investigation. WBUR's Kathleen McNerney has been following this story and joins me now. Hi there, Kathleen.
Hey, Deb.
So this is complicated. So let's start with the suit and Ramirez's involvement.
Right. So remember that when Ramirez was selected to lead the MBTA about a year ago, he was touted as a turnaround specialist. And so before coming to the T, Ramirez led a consulting company and was CEO of Global Power Equipment Group, as you had mentioned. And this suit stems from his time there.
Okay, so is he cleared of wrongdoing, or what happened here?
Legally, it appears so right now. The plaintiffs could still appeal the judge's ruling, but in this ruling that came out earlier this month, the federal judge said that there was evidence that Ramirez and the company's chief financial officer knowingly published false financial information about one of the units within Global Power. Now, this was a big multi-million dollar corporation. But the judge says that wrong information was not large enough to affect whether investors wanted to buy stock in the company.
But Global Power had to restate 3 years' worth of financial statements to the Securities and Exchange Commission because of accounting errors.
Right. And as we reported before, those accounting errors that were disclosed in 2015 were disclosed 2 months after Ramirez left as CEO, and they had a big impact on the company's bottom line. For example, in its filings for 2014, Global Power initially reported that it had a net income of $11 million, when in reality, the company actually had a net loss of $47 million. That's a change of 524%.
So even though there was false financial information, the suit was dismissed. Why?
Because the lawsuit based its arguments on that one business segment within Global Power. I spoke with Andrew Vollmer. He leads the law and business program at the University of Virginia Law School, and he's an expert in securities law.
The judge said it wasn't clear that the defendants knew that the information they were aware of was significant or important to investors in the company.
So that's kind of what it hinges on, is what the intent and knowledge was, right? And as the judge writes, those errors in that one unit only accounted for a relatively small amount of the overall accounting errors in the company.
Any response from the MBTA or state officials?
No comment, and noting that the lawsuit was an issue that didn't involve the MBTA.
All right, WBUR's Kathleen McNerney, thanks for coming in.
Thank you, Deb.
For more details on this story, go to our website, radioboston.org.